This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 2017 marked a unique moment for journalism. Headlines broke each hour. Conversations that long took place in the margins were brought to the center, and a rapidly changing social and political tide touched nearly every aspect of American life. With all of this barely in the rearview mirror, it is time to look back at the year. And our tradition here at the State of Things is to hear from our staff about some of their favorite moments. Joining me now from behind the glass is managing editor Anita Rao. Anita, welcome back to this side of the glass.
Thank you, Frank. Happy to be here.
Though not any stranger to this, we'll talk about your hosting in a moment. But first, let's talk about the first story that you want to talk about today.
Yes. So as you said, it has been quite a year. As a journalist, it's been hard at times to keep up with the ever-changing news cycle. But one of the conversations I picked resonates now more than ever. It's a conversation we recorded back in August when there were some allegations against a director of a local comedy theater. And so a number of individuals in that community wanted to start a conversation about how improv and theater spaces are a unique kind of space where lines get blurred and it's easy for people to not know exactly what each other's boundaries are. So it's especially important to have conversations that make people feel comfortable and safe. So they invited a woman named Gail Stern to come, and she's done a lot of work facilitating these conversations in various communities around the country.
Let's hear part of that conversation now.
It's interesting because the bulk of my company's work now and my work is with military audiences. And in many ways, I think military audiences have a lot in common with improvisational and stand-up communities, especially if you're an outsider and you're trying to prove that you're the equal of everyone out there. And in both cultures, you have to prove that you're tough, you can take anything, and that you're not a sensitive, special little snowflake. And whether you're a female soldier or a Marine or a female improviser, you're keenly aware that you are operating in a world that has been dominated by men, and you have to prove yourself. And the challenge within an improv theater community specifically is you're discouraged from saying no. The cardinal rule of improv is the concept of yes and. You say yes to anything that happens, and then you build on that. And while creatively empowering and awesome, this can put vulnerable people at a disadvantage because it means they're never allowed to set a boundary. Because, A, if they do, they look like they can't take it. They're not tough enough. They're not cool enough. They're not edgy enough. And that allows more aggressive people to keep pushing that boundary and putting them at risk.
And are there certain types, I guess, certain behaviors that get replayed and replicated primarily because this has been a male-dominated field? So when it comes, I mean, maybe talk more about the improvisational process and how you might set up a scene, and then the next actor will add that the next portion to which you must say yes. Is there a way in which the scenes tend to prefer, you know, male preferences because they've dominated the scene for so long?
What you will often see is, let's say there's a male initiates the scene. Female walks in, perhaps she says something like, I've discovered that dinosaur bone. And the guy says, go clean that in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, her act of contribution becomes framed as, you're going to do a traditional woman thing with that now. Now, again, she certainly has the option to say, I would love to take it into the kitchen of my lab and discover what this bone can do. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea that women are frequently cast in the moment as the whore, the mom, the girlfriend, very traditional female roles without any latitude to push that boundary. In addition, women's bodies are often used as props, where it's, if I can get a laugh out of squeezing your boobs right there on stage, I don't have to ask you about it because the laugh is the referendum on whether or not it was good, as opposed to even having a conversation beforehand and saying, hey, what parts of your body can I touch if the scene goes this way? There's no conversation about that. It's in the moment, justification. I just did it because it was funny and I got a laugh. And that also puts women in particular at risk because they're the ones whose boobs are frequently grabbed.
Well, let's
talk. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And then, so I guess it sets up the what to do about it, right? Some of the solutions. And you've spent the last year working with improv communities, or one in Chicago in particular, which is dealing with a number of complaints about harassment. Talk a bit about your work and about some of the ways in which, you know, you can push back against this.
I should say that there's a deep fear that when we talk about language and behavior, that we're going to take the edge away from comedy. And that almost seems to be, next to getting the laugh, the most aspirational concept. I want to be edgy and transgressive. And so one of the things that I talked about with the community and they were on board with, which is understanding if I'm reinforcing the norm, if that's sexist, if that's racist, if that's transphobic, that is the opposite of edgy. That is co-signing on the most corrosive aspects of accepted culture. So you don't want to do that. And then what I noticed is that male improvisers were standing up and saying, you know what I can do? I need to stop this.
That's a clip from a conversation I had with Gail Stern in August of this year. She is the co-founder of Catharsis Productions. I'm here with State of Things managing editor Anita Rao talking about her favorite segments of the year. What struck you about that conversation, Anita?
So I think now with the hashtag MeToo movement, we're sort of in this new cycle of naming names and naming these men who are in positions of power that have abused those positions. But I think it's important to also keep in mind, in addition to the naming names, there is this bigger culture of violence and privilege that we need to unpack so that this doesn't keep happening in workplaces around the country. So I think Gail did a great job of really getting to the heart of the deeper conversation.
And another way we got at that was an event that we recorded in October at the Carolina Women's Center. Tell us more.
That's right. So one of the fun things we get to do on this show is occasionally partner with institutions in the community that want to bring some aspect of the State of Things to a new audience. So we recorded a conversation at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill to celebrate the anniversary of the Carolina Women's Center. And it was sort of a where are we now in feminism? They were having a year-long set of these conversations, and so we kicked it off in front of a live audience.
Okay, let's hear the clip of that conversation. We start with historian Lisa Levenstein, who works at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She was talking about trends that have shaped the feminist movement.
I think we have to go back to the 1990s, and this was a moment, I've done a lot of research on this decade, and this is a moment when really people were saying two things about the movement. One was there were the people who had said, feminism is over, it's dead, you know, that we're in a post-feminist generation. That was one refrain that you might hear sometimes in the media. But another refrain, which I think is the more interesting refrain and is something that has really borne out in my own research, I've been doing research on this for several years now, people would say, feminism, it's everywhere. What that captured was a real distinction between the feminism of the 60s and the 70s, which, you know, we think of as, you know, the kind of sit-ins, the marches, the consciousness-raising groups. Suddenly in the 90s, it seemed to be everywhere, but no one could really put their finger on where the everywhere was. Two things I think might be important for us to start thinking about. First is kind of institutionalization. And I think it's really interesting that we're here today to celebrate the anniversary of the Women's Center. So, because one of the things that happened to feminism is it became institutionalized. And by that I mean it became embedded in institutions such as universities being one. There were both women's studies departments, women's centers, student organizations on campus doing feminist work. But you also saw it in other institutions, in the healthcare sector, women's health specialties, for example, in the legal sector. So feminism is it becoming institutionalized, and so this is a new kind of a new look for feminism, and it's harder to put your finger on where it is.
Still with me is Lisa Levenstein, a professor of history at UNC Greensboro, and joining the conversation now is Naomi Randolph. She is executive director of Women Advance. That's a nonpartisan organization that works to build community around women's issues in North Carolina. Naomi, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here. Naomi, how do you see the feminist movement now? Where are we?
From our viewpoint, the movement is both experiencing a renaissance, and we're also in peril. That interesting dichotomy. So the space in terms in which I believe that we're in a renaissance is that all of these wonderful, dynamic, vibrant voices are coming into the movement with full voice. People are coming in fully amplified and fully clear about what it is that's important to them, what their values are as a part of the movement. So from that space, I think we're in a renaissance. I think that there are lots of beautiful things being birthed in the movement right now. I also think that we're in peril. And the reason I think that we're in peril is because we have to be collectively a bit more visionary. And I think that we also have to be a bit more strategic. The moment that we have been in over the past 15 years, perhaps, maybe the past 20 years, has us being very reactionary. So we're responding to things consistently. If we look at movements and their sustainability and their survival, there has to be a space at which you're not responding all the time and you're building. And so as a movement, we have to find a balance of being able to bring in all of these new wonderful voices, to also have a framework to bring them into, and then to have our eye on 2040, 2050. Mm-hmm. What do we want to not have a conversation about in 2050, right?
What do we want to have been solved by
exactly.
now? Yeah. That's a clip from our State of Things conversation recorded in October in front of a live audience at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill. I am talking with State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao about her favorite moments from 2017. What stood out for you?
So I think this is the kind of conversation that can be such a challenge as a producer. You're tackling a huge subject. Where is the feminist movement in 2017? But the wonderful thing about living where we live is that we have so many great local resources and people that can share their individual perspective as it relates to this topic. So it's sort of a creating a structure and then going back and finding the right guests to create the best conversation. So I was really happy with the diversity of subjects and guests that we had on the show.
There is much more of that ahead as my conversation with Managing Editor Anita Rao continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today with State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao. She's with me to share her favorite SOT conversations from 2017. What's next?
So I have been with the State of Things since 2014, but this year I made two transitions. One of them was to Managing Editor, which I'll talk about a bit later, but the other was to fill-in host. So you were gone this summer, and I filled in for you for 2 days. And so the next clip I have is from one of those segments that I recorded. It is with a man named John Duberstein. And his late wife, Nina Riggs, had passed away just a few months before we spoke. But he was actually on a book tour for the memoir that she had written. The book was called The Bright Hour.
And you start by asking him to tell the story from the beginning of the book that sets up one of the book's central themes.
So one of the things she writes about in the New York Times column that then sort of continues to play out during the book is this theme of how you live a meaningful life with limited time. And she has this beautiful story in the prologue about teaching your son to ride his bike without training wheels. Can you tell us a bit about that story and how it sort of sets up what the whole book is about?
Yeah, we were sort of nursing Benny towards being able to ride his bike without training wheels.
Benny's your younger son.
He's the younger of our two kids, and he's by far the more cautious. And here in that very moment, that was the first indication we really had that her cancer was going to be metastatic. We didn't know at that point, of course, but we knew something was really wrong. I mean, she was in an enormous amount of pain. But in that moment was this, you know, really wonderful, successful moment of parenting. And Benny, of course, was thrilled. And I think if you could reduce the book to a single theme, I think it's exactly what you said. It is, those things don't stop being meaningful. They don't stop being wonderful, even just because you're more acutely aware than most people are of how limited your time is.
So she's processing a lot of the things that are happening to her and your family in real time, which means that you all become characters. You're living the lives and you're also characters in the book. What was that experience like? And maybe you can set up one of the readings I think you're going to do for us where you very much had to witness yourself as a character.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. Her, she wrote the New York Times piece late summer. And then in September of 2016, it came out in the New York Times. I think it was mid-September or late September. And then between then and January, when she handed in the final manuscript, she wrote the book. So obviously a lot of the events that are depicted in the book happened in that time period. Seeing yourself portrayed for the first time can be weird, but And it was. And the scene that I'm going to read, I would say, is probably the most, initially, was the most difficult for me to read. And I said to her, I think, yeah, this one really threw me for a loop. And she said, oh, really? You know, do you want me to change anything? And I thought about it for a few minutes and I said, no, you nailed it. Like, you got it absolutely right. That's why it was hard for me to read, I think, initially. And now it's one of my favorite passages in the whole book, because I think it captures so much of what we struggled with as a couple. And it's called Dispatch from the Dark. Speaking of the dark, it's past midnight and we're lying in bed. I just can't wait for things to get back to normal, says John from his side of the moon. I'm not sure how to respond. I hadn't realized how attached I have become to the idea that, even in all of this, we are moving ahead somehow, and that dealing with all this is something to value. I feel a sharpness in my throat, the slip of the sureness beneath me. I can't handle you saying that, I say after a silence, even though I know he isn't trying to fight. Thinking that way kind of invalidates my whole life right now. I have to love these days in the same way that I love any other. There might not be a normal from here on out. He's not happy. I feel the cool bricks of an invisible wall settling into place between us. I turn away to face the window, a heavy orange haze filtering in through the trees. It's not as dark out as it should be. I don't believe you, he says. I don't think you're being honest. It's the tone I've heard him use when I've told him he's being a crappy parent, or that no matter what, I'm probably never going to like watching hockey. Anger that morphs from hurt. I really think that you're in some kind of whacked out denial right now if you think these days are lovable. These days are days, I say, calm and furious. We choose how we hold them. Good night. Around 4 a.m., I feel his hand on my back. I'm so afraid I can't breathe, he whispers. I know, I say, scooching a little toward him, but still facing away. So am I.
That's John Duberstein reading from The Bright Hour, a memoir of living and dying, written by his wife, Nina Riggs. So Nina passed earlier this year. Now you're doing events around the book that she wrote about her life living and dying. What do you think she would say if she could sort of see you here talking about her book and her first sort of collection of published work?
Gosh, I don't know. I think she would be thrilled. You know, obviously she'd rather be here doing it herself, and I would rather that she be doing that too. But we talked about it a lot. What she told me literally was, I want you to do everything that you feel good doing and be as engaged in it as you want to be. And for me, ever since the moment she was gone, the happiest and most complete that I've been in terms of this stuff is actively working on the project. And it, you know, it's one of the common myths of bereavement that you're not supposed to bring up the person who died, and it's exactly the opposite. Obviously, most people who have been through it know that, but every chance I get to talk about her and to talk about the book is just, it's a thrill for me, and it's cathartic, it's therapeutic. So I think she'd be really happy with that. I think she'd be really pleased.
That's a clip from a State of Things conversation recorded in June between John Duberstein and State of Things managing editor Anita Rao, filling in as host for a guy named Frank. See, you are, by the way, an excellent host.
Thank you, Frank.
And I can't wait for people to say, when are you going to leave, Frank, so that Anita can do this? Because it really is. Well, I'm going to talk to you in a minute about the hosting part, but let's stick with that conversation for a minute and what it was about that conversation that made it one of your favorites.
Yeah. So I remember one of the things that you told me when I was preparing to host was to take risks, to really sit with the person in the moment. And if there's a question that crosses your mind, just ask it and see what happens. So the whole time that I was sitting with John, it had been only a few months since his wife had passed away. And I was starting to feel this creeping sense of, how are you sitting here talking to me? Like, this is so fresh. This is so new. But I was almost afraid to ask the question because it's so directly related to his grief. But at one point toward the end of the interview, I just said, like, how does it feel to be sitting in this chair? And what do you think your wife would think? And this sort of like look of recognition passed across his face. And then it turned out to be one of the best moments of the conversation because he said, you know, one of the common myths of bereavement is that people think you don't want to talk about the person that you've lost, but actually that's all you want to talk about. And I honestly feel the most alive when I am talking about Nina. So is this sort of perfect full circle of I took this risk, I felt really vulnerable, but it turned out to be a really revelatory moment in the conversation.
I want to hear more about this now. From your perspective, someone who has produced this show for a long time and tried to put something together, but you're stuck with this guy who at the end of the day is going to have to deliver or not on your great ideas as the host. Did it change anything for you to sit on this side of the glass and actually host the show, sit in this chair and sort of have to make the decision you have to make? And did it change anything for you?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is it made me more compassionate with you when you go off script and less frustrated when you don't follow the question line that I've laid out, because you realize that in the moment you're responding to so many things when you're hosting. You're making eye contact. You're trying to keep the person engaged in this very sacred bond that the two of you have just created together. And you have the script as an outline, but you can't necessarily go the direction the script went because something has happened now between you and this person.
How does that change things to you? Because you talked earlier about this. It was advice I gave you, but something that I've learned and learned from other hosts, which is to take that risk. If the question crosses your mind, ask it, even if it's dangerous. When you think about now producing a show, does it change anything for you in what you're looking for in a guest or what you might expect out of a segment?
Good question. I think I've been better able to prep you to say, no matter where the direction this conversation goes, it's going to be a good one. This guest can carry with these wide variety of themes. So it's less saying cue all of these specific stories and more giving you a sense of these are all of the ways in which this guest can really open up and the conversation can open up. I think I've also realized that the bond between the producer and the host is so important. I feel like as a host, I was really nervous going into these interviews, but I had to know that, yes, I've done my own research, but I have to really trust the producers who've given me this information because I'm going to go out on a limb and hopefully it turns out well.
That's the thing I like to stress over and over again as a host when people give me all the credit for this and I point to the staff and they think I'm being humble. It's not, I mean, I'm not. I have to say that I have a certain talent. You do as a host. Yes, I bring that to the table. But if I didn't have explicit trust, faith that your judgment about how good this person is as a guest, your research is solid so I can trust what I'm saying. If I didn't have that, I can't fly at this and I won't take those risks. I've got too many other things to think about. So it really is important to have great people working for you, like you, who can do both. So that's great. Well, what have you picked out next?
So next, I have a segment picked out from the managing editor hat that I have put on this year. So we had a retreat a couple of months ago where we wanted to take a look at where the show is today. What is its legacy? Where has it come from? And where are we going? And what, if anything, do we feel is missing? And so one of the things that we talked about was that we used to do a lot of concept shows, which is where you talk about one concept and you play it out throughout the hour. The other is that the State of Things used to do more call-in shows, which is where we would have listeners call in and talk about different stories. And we hesitate to do that for various reasons, but the next segment I have is an example of a call-in show that went really well. We spoke with a researcher and psychologist, Eli Finkel, who had just written a book called The All or Nothing Marriage.
All right, and I asked him here to explain the concept of an all or nothing marriage, and here's what he had to say.
So the basic idea of the all or nothing marriage is that the best marriages are better than we've ever seen before, and the average marriage at the same time is actually getting worse. So we're seeing some divergence where the best marriages are really strong, whereas, you know, more and more of us are actually, you know, limping along a little bit.
All right, so what makes a good marriage? What makes those best marriages really, really strong?
Well, what I think is interesting is that the same trend actually caused both the best marriages to get better and the average marriages to get a little bit worse. And that trend is, as we arrived at this third era of marriage, which really started in the 1960s and that we could call a self-expressive era, we no longer were satisfied with just love, right? So for the first time ever, you start to hear people saying things like, well, he's a lovely man and a good father and I respect him, but I feel stagnant in the marriage and I'm not going to stay like that for the next 30 years. And so there's this emphasis these days that the marriage not only should be a place of love, but also a place of personal growth and movement toward a more authentic, ideal self sort of existence. So the issue is that makes it harder to achieve a good marriage. That means that a marriage that would have been sufficient to meet our expectations in the 1950s falls short of our expectations today, and more of us are disappointed. But at the same time, those high expectations put within reach a level of marital fulfillment that was out of reach in an era that we weren't even trying to achieve those sorts of things. And so it's those marriages that are looking for these, you know, really deep levels of emotional fulfillment and actually achieving those things that are so profoundly fulfilling today.
I'm talking to Eli Finkel, the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. We're also taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Chris is on the line. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've gone through marriage counseling. I'm supposed to be married on the 27th of next month, and Gary Chapman's got the 5 love languages. We're a young couple, and I guess I'm trying to just get insight on what else can we do to kind of move away from that selfishness of still, like, our young, immature ways and move towards, like, the selflessness, just be successful as a couple. And
well, it's a great question. Eli, what do you think? I mean, it is an interesting question in a way, because what do you do with the idea that I got this great feeling now, and Eli just told me I'm not going to have it forever. So what should I be looking for? How do I know that this is really the person when that feeling fades away? It's a great question. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I talk about marriage as like a beautiful leap of faith, right? There are no guarantees, and it's one of the beautiful things that we do is we say, yes, there are no guarantees, and yet here I am and here you are, and let's do this thing. I do want to make a distinction between something that is oriented toward the self or relevant to fulfilling the self and something that is necessarily selfish. And this is one of the issues that I do tackle in the book. Is for a long time, I mean, going back to the 1700s, people were concerned that once marriage became about personal fulfillment, it actually would become incompatible with the idea of marital commitment. Like, if the point of marriage is to make you feel, like, happy and pleasured, then why would you stick with a marriage during those inevitable periods that are actually difficult and challenging and aren't that fun? And it turns out that there's more than one way of thinking about personal fulfillment, even if you're talking about the self. And so one of them is about, like, having things be easy and pleasurable. And I do think that is incompatible with marital commitment. That is, if you're really trying to build a marriage that's just sort of easy and pleasurable and doesn't really have hardness in it, then you will end up disappointed. And you're at risk, I think, for having a marriage that ends in divorce or at least that disappoints you quite a bit. But there's another version of personal fulfillment. And instead of talking about, you know, pleasure and maybe just feeling good about the self, you could talk about meaning and purpose, right? And so if we're trying to develop not necessarily a life filled with pleasure, but a life filled with meaning and purpose, frequently oriented towards something greater than the self, then there's no longer any incompatibility between trying to achieve personal fulfillment and trying to achieve marital commitment, especially because building and sustaining a long-term marriage is one way through which a lot of us seek to reach a meaningful, purposeful life. And so I guess to conclude that, I would encourage people who are about to take the leap to jettison the goal that marriage will be a chronic bed of roses, and instead think of it as something that will be lovely and beautiful and difficult, and that conquering the difficulties will be one of the ways through which we can grow to build a meaningful, purposeful life.
What should we do? Give us some kind of quick advice on simple things that we can do to really refresh and examine our marriage. Keep it going.
The book talks about 8 different love hacks. All of these are based on evidence, right? All of these are science-based procedures that psychologists have identified over the last 10 years or so, and they don't take much time. So one of my favorites is one that we actually developed in our lab, which is how do you deal with conflict, right? So obviously there's all sorts of really good solutions to conflict, and I talk about a lot of those when I talk about how people can go all in trying to make their marriage as strong as possible. But are there quick and dirty things we can do? It turns out that thinking about conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody is something that can actually strengthen the marriage, not only in terms of feeling happier in the marriage, but also in terms of making us feel a little bit more passionate in our marriage, which is, again, something of a holy grail in trying to make marriages better. It's hard to increase levels of passion, but it looks like this procedure of adopting a neutral, generous third-party perspective during conflict can accomplish quite a bit.
I also like what you say about gratitude. That can be so difficult in a marriage of any number of years because you take things for granted. So when somebody takes out the trash and that suddenly becomes their job, it's like, oh, the trash got taken out. You didn't even think about it. You just say, thanks for taking out the trash.
Yeah, I mean, the love hacks, all of the love hacks are inspired by Marcel Proust's observation that mystery is not about traveling to new places, but about looking with new eyes. Mm. And so there's a set of procedures that we can use to try to just look with generous new eyes at the everyday, at the mundane. And you give a good example, right? So there's research that randomly assigns people to various conditions. And one of the conditions is think about ways that your partner has made sacrifices for the relationship. And it turns out that people who write about that, who actually take just a few minutes to think about those sorts of things, end up being more grateful and happier and feel more committed to the relationship than people assigned to think about other sorts of things. Now, I ask the listeners, you know, do you have 5 minutes a month to think about ways that your partner has actually really invested in the relationship? It's a nice thing to feel grateful and to feel happy in the relationship.
That is a clip from a State of Things conversation recorded in September with researcher and psychologist Eli Finkel. I am here with State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao. Just ahead, we continue to look back at some of the highlights of our show from this past year. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today to Managing Editor Anita Rao, who's taking us behind the scenes at The State of Things and telling us about her favorite moments of 2017. What's next?
So this is one of those segments that comes about purely because of serendipity. So you never know who's listening at any given time. And this segment is a perfect example of that. So back in 2016, we had a conversation with Sherry Castle. She's a cookbook writer and a chef, and she was talking about a recent cookbook she had published that collected recipes from Southern living over the years. And one of the stories she talked about was a recipe that had come from a postman in North Carolina who made friends along his route and developed a recipe for a cream cheese pound cake. So she told us that story. And then the next day, I got an email from her that I actually have here. So she says, "Good morning, Anita. I actually just received an email from Eddie McGee of the famous cream cheese pound cake. He's still in North Carolina in Stokes County and still makes cakes and is also the head of the Stokes Art Council. Radio has power." So I said, wait a second. Eddie McGee is still out there. Now he's working at the Arts Council. We've got to find him. So we did. And he joined us on our show to tell us his backstory and the story of these cheesecakes.
Beginning with how he ended up as a postmaster.
A postal service job, everyone says it's great pay and great benefits. It's a solid job. And when you get out of college, that's what you're at that mm-hmm. time was pushed to go into. And so actually had a friend who was in management and went to the Postal Service. And he said, "I think you'll be a good addition. Why don't you apply? And you have to take the test." And so I went through that process. And there I was. But it was somewhat of a mundane job. No offense to the postal folks out there. But I wanted to make it more than just putting mail in a box.
So that's when you started to develop these relationships. You spent time. You talked about the biscuits. Tell us about Dottie's biscuits.
Dorothy Swift, in Elkin. And she was the one that, I guess, started it all for me. And little tidbits about or advice, don't ever put soap on your tin pan when you're making biscuits. You just brush it off. Some of you probably already know this. And she cooked for me every day. Fried chicken. And, you're a mailman. You're trying to keep the weight off. And there's a lady that comes up every day with fried chicken and biscuits and mashed potatoes. But she was an amazing lady. And taught me a lot.
When you started reciprocating, was that just out of, some sense of gratitude? Or did you feel like you wanted to test their recipes and say, was this it?
Well, again, I've been cooking since I was very, very young. Both of my parents cooked. And so it was somewhat out of reciprocation, but I wanted to, to learn from them.
Yeah.
And unlike today, where we were running a fast food restaurant at that time, everyone was baking. So I wanted to learn the secrets. But I had a few secrets of my own that my grandmother had taught me. And actually, the way the cream cheese pound cake came about was a couple of recipes, because we would share recipes. So the ladies would exchange recipes with me, and I would experiment in the kitchen back then a lot more than I do now, and that's how that one recipe developed. Yeah.
People liked it. So now here's the cool thing. So now you've got this cream cheese pound cake, and it's a success. At least it's a hit on the route. And then you find out about it, but you don't get the call directly from Southern Living Magazine. Your boss did.
No, I got back off of my mail route. At the time, a gentleman named Floyd Benfield was my postmaster, and there was a note on my case that said, come see me. So I go back to see Floyd, and he said, close the door. And I sat down, and he said, so I hear you've been baking for the folks on your route. So I've been doing this unbeknownst to everyone in the office. And I said, yeah, I've been doing that. Am I in trouble? He goes, oh, no, Southern Living called today. They want to do a special on you. I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
And so Southern Living, I contacted them, and they sent a reporter up and a photographer. And first I had to submit. They wanted me to submit two of my best recipes. Yeah.
So that and what was the other recipe?
A Moravian sugar cake recipe.
Okay. So, but now it turns out they tested both, and the pound cake was off the charts, right?
Pound cake was off the charts. It's got the highest rating it had ever had of a pound cake at that time for Southern Living.
Yeah.
And so I remember to this day, I still remember when they were taking pictures when they came up for the article, and the photographer said, smile. 20 million people worldwide are going to see your face, and your life will never be the same. And so I think the picture, I was actually in shock, because after the picture, I just laughed. I said, this is a joke. And here I am 22 years later, we're still talking about a cream cheese pound cake.
That's a clip of a State of Things conversation recorded at the Triad Stage in Greensboro on February this year. I am here with State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao, talking about her favorite picks from 2017. One of the things I love about that is that you find a guy who gives out cheesecakes as a postman and now is the head of the Stokes County Arts Council. They live here in North Carolina. Some of the most amazing people and amazing stories, and people ask us where they come from. It's the state of North Carolina. It's a great place to do this kind of a job. Right?
It is. It really is. Everything is connected. And the arts here is connected to everything else. So it's wonderful.
So what's next?
So next we are going to play a conversation with comedian Aparna Nancherla. So I have followed her for a long time. She is an Indian American comedian, and there aren't a lot of Indian American comedians out there. And she just has a hilarious Twitter presence. She's been known to be the creator of Sad Girl Twitter, which is Twitter where you make a lot of comedy about depression, anxiety, and mental health in general. So she was coming here to do, was headlining a show, I think, for the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival. And so we brought her into the studio to talk before she came on.
And this clip actually starts with an excerpt of her stand-up.
I actually find it weirder to not have anxiety than to have it, because I feel like if you're not scared, you're not paying attention, you know? If you open a newspaper today and you skim the headlines, you're just like, seems cool. It's like, what? Everything's on fire! Are you kidding me? And sometimes people are like, oh, well, you know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Have you checked out some of Fear's work? Pretty much churning out the hits. Since forever. Making a lot of great points. If you don't have anxiety, to me, what it feels like is there's like an edgy improv group in your brain that just needs like a one-word suggestion to spin like countless scenarios that no one's comfortable with.
Aparna Nancherla and her stand-up album, Just Putting It Out There, released last summer. What about this, talking about your anxiety, and you also talk about depression. When did you decide to do that?
Well, I think I've always gravitated towards comics who are pretty open about their struggles with mental health and are okay with getting vulnerable on stage. Like, I've always looked up to like Maria Bamford, and I didn't know if I had anything necessarily to add to the conversation since so many people were doing it well, but I first started writing about it sort of because I was in a depressive rut and I was having trouble really creating anything. So I was like, well, I guess if this is where you're at, just try to write about that. So I kind of wrote about it just to get myself out of it. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily that was the only solution, but I did realize like talking about it on stage, like it would really resonate with people, and they responded favorably to it. So I think I sort of continued down that path.
Does your writing, I mean, is it different if you're in a high state of anxiety or depression? Is it different than I mean, is it better? Or would you rather be in that state to write? Or
I wouldn't say it helps. Like, I know there is that tortured artist sort of trope, and I wouldn't say that, you know, having depression and anxiety is like what fuels my writing. But I think people with that prone to that sort of neurotic mindset do look at the world in a certainly like sort of hyper analytical way that can lend itself to comedy. But I wouldn't say like if you don't have depression, you're at a disadvantage.
Well, but I want to follow up on what was in that little clip that we played. I mean, you just called it a sort of a neurotic mind state as though that's the abnormal. But really, shouldn't we all be a little bit out of our minds right now? I mean, that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of jealous of that level of, you know, being not impacted by your surroundings. But at the same time, like now most of my social circle is like somehow involved in comedy or something creative. And that mindset definitely skews towards very hyper aware of what's going on, very sensitive to a lot of issues. So I think, yeah, I think for me, it does seem more abnormal to be kind of removed from your day-to-day surroundings.
We also talked about the how-to, and we had a comedian Hari Kondabolu on the show, and we were talking about how Indian comedians, South Asian comedians, are often expected to put on certain characters or accents. I wonder if you have thought about that and how that affects you and your experience in being on stage.
Yeah, I think when I first started, you know, I was a South Asian female comedian, and there wasn't necessarily anyone else who looked like me or sounded like me on the scene where I started in D.C. So I think in that sense, I was lucky that I didn't have any sort of person that people were comparing me to. That sometimes happens with minorities. But I came to comedy from sort of a, you know, as we spoke about earlier, like living inside my head and sort of observing the world from the corner. So I think that's what interested me to write about and to be sort of like an observer of the world. And I feel like sometimes with racial comedy or cultural comedy, it's more from the outside in, where it's like, this is what I look like and this is how I've been treated because of it. So I think I sort of have always come at it from the opposite way. So I just haven't gravitated towards writing about that stuff.
That's a clip from my conversation earlier this year with comedian Aparna Nancherla. I am here with State of Things managing editor Anita Rao, who's telling us about her favorite moments of 2017. What'd you like about that one?
So this is one of those where you're surprised with interviews that you really geek out about. And she was one of those for me just because I'd been following her for so long. And I happened to find out right before we recorded the conversation that her mom and my dad had actually gone to middle school together and had grown up in India. So there were all of these factors that sort of came together that made me really excited to talk with her. And I really love that her identity is part of her comedy, but she describes herself as a comedian that talks from the inside out. So you wouldn't necessarily know if you just heard her voice that she was an Indian American. And I love that.
You have one more segment for us. And this one is from a conversation that we had with science writer Jennifer Ackerman. Tell us about that one.
Yes. So Jennifer Ackerman had written a book called The Genius of Birds. And this book came across my desk. And one of the interesting things about this job as a producer is you become an expert overnight about a topic that you hadn't given much thought to before. So when I first saw this book, my gut reaction was no, because I actually am really afraid of birds and have quite a bird phobia. So I did a quick Google of Jennifer, and then I realized I couldn't say no to this segment because it was fascinating. So she's a science writer, and she traveled all over the world researching birds from all over the world and uncovering how incredible they are and how their brains are actually much more closely wired and connected than we have ever thought. And the phrase bird, calling someone a bird brain as a derogatory comment, is actually very untrue. Birds are very smart. So I ended up really loving this segment.
Jennifer Ackerman, and I asked her to tell us the story of a bird that she says is arguably the smartest bird in the world, the New Caledonia crow from the South Pacific island of New Caledonia.
This bird is an expert problem solver, and it's also renowned for its capacity to make and use its own tools, complex tools on par, really, with primates like chimps and orangutans.
Tell us about the tools.
Well, it's the only species other than humans to make hook tools like that Betty the New Caledonian crow made. And they make them in the wild. And these are sticks with a little hook on the end that they use to poke into holes to grab grubs. They also make tools from pandanus leaves, which are, it's a common plant on the island. And the really interesting thing is that they seem to have different styles of pandanus tool making in different parts of the island. And these styles of toolmaking are passed down over generations, which, if you think about it, the faithful transmission of tool design, that's a very good definition of culture.
That's cultural transmission right there. And right. It is fascinating that it is learned behavior and passed down and not just something that becomes obvious to each bird.
Correct. It is, it's an astonishing complexity of toolmaking.
A lot of social behavior, too, that is learned. Maybe one of the better ways to describe how this works, I think, an example in the book was mobbing, that some birds which chase, for instance, cuckoos out of their nest or other birds that they find are pesty, will sort of mob, you know, in big numbers. But that they can learn to get rid of these birds, even if they're not hardwired.
Right. And one of the really interesting experiments that went on in this area was by John Marsliff at the University of Washington. And he had his researchers wear a caveman mask when they caught crows and banded them. And catching and banding a crow is a fairly traumatic experience for the crow. So what Marsliff discovered was that when he and his group returned to this area where they had banded the crows, wearing the mask, they were mobbed by not just the crows that they banded, but their family members, their offspring. And this happened year after year after year, up to 9 years later. Wow. They were still mobbing these caveman masks.
So remembering some form of recall. Also, ravens, a unique example of animals with empathy.
Yes, this is really fascinating work done at the University of Vienna. Ravens live in, they're very social birds, and they live in groups. And it's not a peaceful kind of harmonious existence. They have a lot of fights and altercations. And what the researchers found is that the ravens that are a victim of a conflict of some kind will be consoled by their mate or their ally. And this is usually involves some kind of preening or twining bills, which is the kind of bird equivalent of kissing.
This also, and so in, as we're listening to this, I think we're all trying to get our heads around, well, what's behind this? How do they, we know kind of empathy when it works at the human level is some sense of putting ourselves in the position of the other. I mean, I think that's how we understand empathy in primates, or at least humans, right?
That's correct. And it's called theory of mind, which is the ability to understand that another being has thoughts, desires of their own that differ from your own thoughts and desires. And we thought this was uniquely human, but it turns out that several species of birds are capable of this kind of empathetic response.
That's a clip from my conversation with Jennifer Ackerman. She's a science writer and the author of the book, The Genius of Birds. And I'm here with State of Things managing editor Anita Rao. And we all love that one. That
was, oh my gosh,
a lot of fun.
Yes.
Did it help you get over your phobia?
It did not.
No, you're even more afraid because they can stalk you.
And they're so smart.
Yeah.
But they're
empathetic,
so I have a little bit more compassion for them as well.
Anita Rao, managing editor of The State of Things. Great year, Anita. Thank you. I look forward to another terrific year. Thanks so much.
Me too. Thanks, Frank.
You can find links to all of our segments on our website, stateofthings.org, a program that is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robert Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachel.